You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Okay, good morning, everyone, and welcome to Brookings. My name is Beth Ferris. I'm a senior fellow in foreign policy here and co-director of the Brookings LSC Project on Internal Displacement. For the past 22 years, we've been working and doing research on internal displacement in a variety of contexts, but I think this is the first time we've ever organized an event focusing specifically on Libya. And certainly this research that was carried out and our concern with the issue predates the current attention being paid to Libya in the context of the migration crisis in Europe, although we will be focusing on that as well. We have a good panel for you today. We're going to begin with Megan Bradley, sitting at my far left. Megan teaches development studies and political science at McGill University in Montreal. She's done a lot of work on transitional justice, displacement, reconciliation, and a variety of contexts. But from our perspective, she's almost coming home. She worked with us for a couple of years as a fellow in the Project on Internal Displacement. And we still miss you a lot, Megan, and it's really nice to see you here with us.
Thank you.
So Megan's going to talk about some of the research that we've carried out in collaboration with colleagues based in Doha. And then we're going to turn to the chargé d'affaires from the Embassy of Tunisia, Qais Daraji, who's a career diplomat, has worked in a variety of settings throughout the Middle East, most recently London, Tokyo, before coming to Washington in 2012. Certainly the consequences for Tunisia of displacement in Libya are something to be considered. We'll then turn to Shelley Pitterman, who's the representative here in Washington, D.C., of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, has worked with UNHCR for many, many years in very different settings, from headquarters to the Middle East and now in Washington, where he also focuses on some of the issues in the Caribbean. But UNHCR has been quite visible in the past week or two with respect to what's happening in the Mediterranean off the coast of Libya. And I hope, Shelley, that you can put this into the broader perspective. We often see that internal displacement within a country has consequences far beyond the borders of those countries, and I think we'll be seeing that as we hear our panelists discuss today. Each of them will talk for a short amount of time, and then we'll open it up for questions, and I hope you are busily thinking about your questions, and we'll look forward to hearing from you. But we'll begin with Megan. Megan, welcome, and tell us about your research.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Beth. It's always nice to come home. Especially when the weather here is much better than it is in Montreal, however cold a spring it might have been here. I'm particularly happy to have the chance to share with you today some of the results of a recent study on the displacement crisis within Libya and across the Libyan borders, particularly into Tunisia. This is a forthcoming report that I've been working on with two colleagues, Ibrahim Sharkia, who's with Brookings Doha Center, and Huda Mziodet, who is a Tunisian researcher and journalist. Huda and Ibrahim took the lead on the fieldwork in Tunisia and Libya that informed this study, so I'd like to start out by acknowledging their key contributions to the project. The report is focused not just on the flow of migrants and asylum seekers across the Mediterranean. Rather, it's focused in particular on the displacement crises that have been affecting Libyan citizens themselves. Although these are clearly interrelated dynamics, and I'm looking forward to speaking about those in the Q&A session. So just to start with the numbers and an overview of some of the displacement dynamics that we look at in the report. The Libyan population, as I'm sure many of you would know, is 6.2 million, so a small country. After the fall of the Gaddafi regime, some 550,000 Libyans were uprooted within the borders of Libya itself. And in addition, an estimated 660,000 Libyans sought shelter in neighboring countries, particularly Tunisia and Egypt. So this is clearly a sizable proportion of the population of a relatively small country. The majority of IDPs who were uprooted in the context of the violence that accompanied the revolution were, for the most part, able to draw on their own resources to return to their homes relatively promptly after the violence concluded. There was, however, a smaller group of about 50,000 people who have ended up in a situation of so-called protracted displacement. So these are individuals who, even today, have still not been able to return to their homes. The greatest proportion of this population is a group of about 40,000 people from the town of Tuerga near Misrata. Perhaps some of you have followed the details of this case, but this is a situation in which the residents of this town, who belong to a particular ethnic group, were accused of loyalty to Gaddafi and involvement in a series of war crimes that were committed against the residents of the city of Misrata. In retaliation, Misratan militias attacked the town, virtually destroyed it, and arbitrarily displaced the entire population. So the UN Commission of Inquiry has referred to this situation as a war crime in and of itself, and as a crime against humanity. So the majority of these IDPs, who are a relatively cohesive and vocal group, are living in IDP camps, principally in Tripoli and Benghazi. With the upsurge of violence that we've seen since the summer of 2014, there's been, in addition to this core group of protracted IDPs, a whole new wave of people who've been forced from their homes. So the best estimates that we have is that there are some 400,000 Libyans who are now uprooted within the country. It's important to stress, though, that because the majority of international actors pulled out of Libya in the summer of 2014, there have been really no regular updated assessments of the size and characteristics of this population. So 400,000 is very much a rough estimate. What we do know for sure is that many of those who are currently uprooted in Libya have been subject to multiple displacements. So they've been forced from the communities in which they sought shelter and still unable to return to their homes. And it's also clear that the almost complete lack of international assistance for IDPs in Libya at the moment has pushed many of these people into situations of deep impoverishment and extreme vulnerability to the ongoing violence. In terms of those who sought shelter outside of Libya, we also saw relatively prompt return movements after the conclusion of the revolution in 2011. However, we do see, and I think Mr. Draghi will speak to this, we did see a significant proportion of the population remain in exile, primarily in Tunisia. Now, many of these individuals are assumed to have some degree of affiliation with or loyalty to the Gaddafi regime. And this has made them unable to return to the country because of fears associated with retaliatory violence. So in thinking about this population, it's important to stress that the vast majority of these people have never been actively involved in any kind of violence or abuses associated with the Gaddafi regime. Instead, this is more a case of guilt by association, people being labeled as loyalists by virtue of family associations, or having that label applied to them in the context of local power struggles. So it's a very complicated case, but it's important to recognize that this is not a group that is uniformly in any way responsible for violence or human rights violations. So, in addition to this group, which has stayed in exile for a longer period of time, there has been, again, a major surge of movement into Tunisia and also into Egypt since the summer of 2014. We don't have good numbers on this population. In the summer, the foreign minister of Tunisia suggested that there are as many as 1.5 million Libyans in Tunisia. A smaller group are understood to have more or less established residency in Tunisia. But again, it's very difficult to assess the scope of the population because Libyans don't actually require a visa to enter Tunisia. So Tunisia has very generously kept their borders open throughout the duration of the crisis. So what we have is a situation of people using their own resources to travel into Tunisia, and they have not, for the most part, actually registered as refugees. Although a sizable proportion of the population would presumably qualify for refugee status. So in effect, Tunisia has really become a major host state in the region, although strikingly, they receive very little international support, which is something that I hope we will discuss further. So if we think about the Libyan crisis in relation to the displacement that's taking place across the Middle East and North Africa at the moment, it's striking how little attention the situation has received, particularly when we're thinking about the displacement of Libyans themselves, and not just the issue of migrants and asylum seekers trying to escape to Europe from Libyan shores. I think that this lack of attention to the Libyan situation is significantly due to the fact that Libya is a relatively well-resourced country, and there's an assumption that Libyans have their own resources to draw on in order to respond to their needs for housing, food, etc. Now, this has meant that until now, there's been relatively low costs of the displacement crisis for European states and also for the U.S. But what I want to stress is that in the longer term, this reliance on the displaced person's own resources is just not tenable. What we saw in our research and interviews with affected populations is that, yes, some people are receiving, for example, regular pension payments from the government, despite the ongoing chaos, which is quite remarkable, but many don't. And so they're eating into their own resources, approaching situations of increasing impoverishment. And in addition to this, many of the IDPs and exiles have protection concerns that money alone can't resolve. So this means that the kind of neglect that the situation has received is not, I think, something that can continue into the future. What we saw in our research is that many Libyans in Tunisia are effectively trying to live under the radar. So the Tunisian government has been remarkably generous in terms of keeping its borders open and enabling this kind of informal protection that Libyans have accessed to date. The government has pledged not to return Libyans while the violence is ongoing and has enabled Libyan children, for example, to go to school. Some are able to access medical care as well. But what we see in countries around the world is that this kind of hospitality does come at a cost when we're talking about displacement situations that are expected to be protracted, and that's certainly the case here. So, for example, we see rents significantly increasing in many Tunisian cities, which is leading to tensions between Tunisians and the Libyan exiles. Many of the Libyan exiles who we interviewed for this study reported that they live basically in perpetual fear of a policy change that would see them be forcibly returned to Libya, where they fear for their lives. I think this suggests that there's a need to consider how the international community, including UNHCR, can better support Tunisia to develop its policies and capacities as a host state and to provide secure and reliable protection to those within their borders. So just to conclude, in terms of responding to and ultimately looking towards the resolution of this displacement situation, I think it's important to recognize the obvious. And this is that it's just impossible to talk about aiding IDPs and resolving the crisis in a sustainable manner without looking at the broader question of conflict resolution and peace building in Libya. So increased security is obviously the essential precondition to stopping displacement and to resolving the predicament of those who've been forced from their homes within Libya and across borders. What we saw in our research is that from the perspective of many uprooted Libyans, return is their preferred solution to displacement, and this is presumably also the preference of the many states and international organizations who are involved. What we see in other cases, though, is that as displacement becomes more protracted, people's preferences and plans can change. And so as the situation continues, it will be important to continue to have open dialogue with the displaced about their preferences and to make sure that their opinions are closely taken into account. So while returns aren't presently possible, I want to close by just highlighting three quick points that will need to be kept in mind moving forward and looking towards an eventual resolution of the situation. First, it's absolutely imperative, it goes without saying, that returns must be voluntary and take place in conditions of safety and dignity, as is required under international law. The flip side of this is that while returns can't be forced, they also can't be banned. So it's important to think about how to overcome, for example, the obstacles that have prevented the people of Tuerga from returning to their homes. Second, we need to think about the relationship between transitional justice, reconciliation, and the ongoing displacement situation in Libya. Transitional justice processes in Libya have been effectively suspended with the violence, but there are, I think, many lessons to be learned from the past failures of the processes that were initiated in 2011. So, for example, the political isolation law that was instituted in Libya was problematic, particularly because of its highly punitive nature. This is an opportunity to try to take stock of some of those shortcomings and ideally have a clearer sense of the way to move forward in future. And last, it's essential to think about how immediate support can be delivered to IDPs and also to exiles in ways that eventually lay the groundwork for durable solutions. So even though return is not an immediate possibility, there are ways in which the populations can be assisted now in ways that will help people to come out from the shadows and not experience a situation of entrenched marginalization, which is the risk that many people, particularly exiles, face at the moment. So this entails, for example, ensuring that Libyan children take up the opportunity that's been presented to them to go to school. Many are still not actually enrolled in schools. This is just one small step that I think is an important part of making sure that this population is not locked into a situation of protracted displacement in the longer term. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Megan. A complex picture of protracted displacements, new displacements within the country, to surrounding countries and further abroad. We turn now to Tunisia. Welcome, Mr. Kaisdaraji, to talk about the experience of your country in dealing with Libyan displacement and the crisis.
Thank you very much. We'd like to think of Libya as an opportunity for Tunisia. Unfortunately, at the moment, it is a problem for the whole region, but we consider it as an internal problem for Tunisia because of the interconnection between the two countries, the two peoples, and the very close relations, historical, cultural, and economic. After the revolution in Tunisia and the revolution in the start of the revolution in Libya, we have received over 1 million Libyans in Tunisia. Most of them relied on their own means in cities, but we have had around 90,000 Libyans who were in refugee camps in Tunisia. Then the success of the Libyan revolution was good news to Tunisia because many of the Libyans, particularly the refugees, went back home. And we all hoped that it would be stability and opportunity for everybody. Unfortunately, things did not turn out to be very easy for everybody, for the Tunisian process too, which was quite long, painful. But for the Libyans, they are going through a more complex and more painful process. Right now it's not easy to give figures, precise figures, but we have an estimation of more than 1 million Libyans living in Tunisia. Most of them are middle-class refugees, we could call them. Most of them are relying on their own means, on their savings, and more or less they are living in very good conditions. The Tunisian law, there is Tunisian-Libyan Convention 1973, which allows Libyans free circulation in Tunisia, freedom to establish business, and to be in Tunisia like any ordinary Tunisian citizen. So in this sense, this is quite a positive picture. In terms of repercussions in Tunisia, I would start with the good news, with the positives. I mean, the Libyans in Tunisia, they come with capital influx, and they help the economy in a sense. I mean, there is an estimation of something around 1 billion euro injected into the Tunisian economy. But unfortunately, this positive picture does not could not hide the negative impact that we have and the pressure that we have on the Tunisian economy and on other aspects. You know, over 1 million, that is more than 10% of the Tunisian population are in Tunisia, and a population increase, a 10% increase of the population with non-productive citizens, that would have inflationary pressure on the Tunisian economy. And Tunisians are feeling that. Obviously, there are other considerations, but it's not the blame is not to be put on this demographic increase, but there are other considerations. But this has contributed to inflation in Tunisia. It has contributed to, as Megan has just said, to rise of rents, to strains on public services, hospitals, schools, transportation systems. But most importantly, and this is being felt in Tunisia, is that they put more pressure on subsidy system in Tunisia. Food subsidies, energy subsidies, and that is something that is being felt. Other negative aspects are related to security, the situation in Libya, the proliferation of weapons, and the situation in Libya has creates some concerns about the possibility of smuggling weapons, and it is taking place, of training Tunisians in Libya. So it creates some kind of precautions about the influx of Libyans to Tunisia, which are quite legitimate in the context of serious security threats, because we have our homegrown security threats and terrorists too, and there is an interconnection between all terrorist organizations through the region. The situation is more complex because in the beginning of the Libyan Revolution, when there was a surge of Libyan refugees, the Tunisian army did not have many assignments. It could deal with the situation, whether in terms of security, whether in terms of organizing refugee camps and facilitating access of Libyans. But now the Tunisian army is quite small, and it has so many missions, and it is involved in a war against terrorism within Tunisia, and it has the task of protecting borders. It does not have the capacity to play the same role that it played in 2011. So these are some of the aspects we have, but apart from these moneyed or urbanite and middle class refugees in Tunisia, we have problem of third nationals. It started in 2011, and we have around 200,000 Eritreans, sub-Saharan Africans who came for refugee status in Tunisia. Most of them have went back home or have been adopted in other host countries in Europe. Some of them, not a great many, are still in Tunisia. The concern is that we hope that the situation in Libya will improve, that the national dialogue underway will come to a positive conclusion, but Tunisia and the whole region has to prepare themselves for the worst. We hope that the experience in August 2014, when the fighting intensified in Egypt after the killing of 21 Copts, Egyptian Copts, there was a surge of new refugees or of border crossing towards Tunisia. That obviously alerted the Tunisian authorities, and that gave us a signal that we have to be prepared for any new surge. The Tunisian economy is not in the same shape as it was in 2011. The army is not in the same readiness as it was in 2011. And to be honest, too, there is in Tunisia a sense of humanitarian fatigue. There was a huge sense of solidarity in 2011 with the Libyan people, with other refugees. There was a sense of willingness to contribute from all citizens to help and to also project that picture of generosity and of solidarity. But there is some kind of fatigue, even within Tunisia itself. There was so many campaigns of people moving from Tunis to inland regions, offering support, offering donations. Now people with the economic situation are not in the same kind of attitude. So these are some of the challenges that we are facing, and that, as Megan has said, that we are facing alone without any international support. But I think the minimum is to try to work on emergency plans to provide logistical support, but also to provide support in terms of management, crisis management, and procedures to deal with a possible new influx of refugees. So shall I stop here? And then maybe we can deal with questions later on.
Thank you very much. And let's turn now to Shelley Pitterman, United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees.
Thank you very much, Beth. It's really a pleasure to be here. My conversation will start with three perspectives, one, the Libya-specific, and then, which I'll speak to briefly, and then, as we must with any refugee situation, look at the neighborhood and then the region, almost by definition. But in the case of Libya, Given the security situation, our physical presence in Libya is naturally quite constrained, which gets to some of the points Megan mentioned about the level of assistance that can be offered to the displaced persons, and in fact to some 40,000 refugees as well, who are, according to our last count, in Libya, mostly in the Tripoli area. So we've had to withdraw our international staff. We've got about 30 to 40 national staff in both Benghazi, principally in Tripoli as well. And we work to the extent that anything can be accomplished in support of the displaced populations that are concentrated in various neighborhoods, because, as you said, they're very dependent on family connections, and they've basically been obliged to go it alone in the Libyan mess. We work through some international NGOs like International Medical Corps. We're working with the Danish Refugee Council, as well as the Libyan Red Crescent and some few national NGOs that are able to get things accomplished. So we continue to try to keep a presence, to provide some minimum, material support, to work with the individuals and respond to individual protection needs. But, you know, there's no illusion here that anything significant on our part is effectively changing their situation in a big way, which I dare say is very often the case with displaced populations because of the nature of the conflicts that they regrettably find themselves in. And Libya is a more extreme example of that, I guess, in the current map of conflict and internal strife. So we watch carefully and optimistically the work of the Special Representative of the Secretary General to find political solution. Apparently, this is a slow and complicated process. It's happening in multiple countries, dealing with multiple actors. And so here again, I think patience is the key. And in that rather sad landscape, Tunisia is a pearl of reception, of asylum, of understanding. And so naturally, UNHCR in particular, but I think all who care, are very grateful for the excellent support that's been provided by Tunisia. When you think of the Tunisian case, in my background, think as well of Lebanon and other countries that have been impacted by the surge of instability and insecurity in North Africa as well as in the center of the Middle East, around the Syrian refugee problem, because there are relationships here. And there's been a lot of focus on how Lebanon has been impacted by the incredible number of Syrian refugees. And I guess we also have to think about Tunisia in a significant way. And we can provide, as an international community, direct support for relief to refugees. But, you know, as you've said, they are part of the community in many ways. They're being integrated through municipal services, health, education. They're living in rented buildings. And they're working on the savings that they've had, the resources that they were able to bring. But as far as this is a protracted displacement, those resources will run dry. And when that happens, we'll find ourselves, and it's happened sooner in Lebanon because of the dramatic quality, the war in Syria. When that happens, those people will suffer more clearly, and it'll have a more dramatic impact on Tunisia. So we have to, I think, already anticipate we have to anticipate the problems that will come with marginalization, with exclusion, with poverty, and with the fact that they are not Tunisian. And as you said, Tunisia had already quite an experience after the revolution, receiving tens of thousands of foreigners, including refugees, in its territory, and dealing with them in a most in a most hospitable way. So the High Commissioner has been looking at this question and advocating for a more proactive approach to development. This is not a relief situation. Tunisia is a middle-income country, just as Egypt on the other side, therefore not necessarily eligible for the types of grants that would normally come from development agencies and international financial institutions like the World Bank. It simply doesn't qualify. But we're trying to make the case, and I guess this is a very effective platform for doing so as well, that it's in the collective interest of the global north and of the people of Tunisia and of the Libyans as well who are impacted by this, that we should think about creative ways to help affected countries to engage in structural, bilateral and multilateral development support, that we shouldn't have to wait until until the problem becomes a crisis, but engage more proactively from the get-go. Tunisia is a case in point, precisely because of the economic hardships that you mentioned, that are facing the country in terms of GDP and so on. But there are other examples around the Nigerian situation, Cameroon, Mali, Niger, Lebanon and Jordan are other important examples, as well as Turkey to a lesser extent, where development institutions and development resources, that's the key, can be leveraged to provide more support, not only to help the countries of asylum, but to give more space and to hopefully address this problem, which is, I think, critical, of hospitality fatigue, of humanitarian fatigue, so that there is a more concrete and short-term benefit beyond the cooking pots and the blankets and the very punctual support to a school here or a medical center there. So this is something that we've been pressing for and looking for creative ways to make that happen. There are some opportunities in the months to come through the G7 conversations or the next annual meeting of the World Bank, with whom we've been working very closely on this. And we hope that there will be advocates in this room and elsewhere to help find the key to a more creative and flexible approach to concessional loans that recognize, in a context like Tunisia, the openness that you've shown as a country and as a nation to refugees from Libya and from elsewhere. The third piece that I'd like to very quickly mention, of course, is that the havoc in Libya, the vacuum of authority, the insecurity and the instability creates a pathway, however risky it may be, for Syrians and Eritreans and others to transit to make their way to safer shores in the north on the one hand, and also for some of the 40,000 or so refugees themselves to exit. And so we have seen from Libya over recent months and years an increase in the outflow of boat people, and also I call them boat people not to conjure up images of years ago, but that's what they are. And we've seen in the tragedy on the Mediterranean last week that they run a terrific risk in doing what they do. It's not a choice. It's not a pull. They're not economic migrants, most of them. They are forced to flee because of the circumstances in their home countries. It's a tragedy within a tragedy, in effect, that they've had to leave Syria or Eritrea or other countries from which they've fled to seek asylum in Libya or to transit through such an insecure environment and be at the behest of traffickers that are also able to flourish in such an environment in order to make their way or to try to make their way to Europe and elsewhere in order to find safety. So I hope we can talk more about that, but I just also don't want to abuse of my opening time to draw the link between Libya, the neighborhood in North Africa. I didn't speak about Egypt, but the same principles exist in general, but Tunisia's open border policy is clearly something that, that UNHCR is very, very appreciative of. And also to make the link that it's the broader region and it has a global impact. Thank you very much.
And thanks to all of you. Before we open it up for discussion, I thought we might just have a little conversation among ourselves. And maybe to start with you, Megan, we know from other experiences that the longer people are displaced, the more protracted the situation, the less likely they are to go home. I mean, are there steps that could be taken now, even given the situation inside Libya, that might facilitate eventual return of Libyans from Tunisia and elsewhere?
I think there are steps. One issue, for example, that certainly will need to be considered is the question of restitution. This is going to be a very complex process. It always is when there have been large-scale displacements through which people have lost their homes. In Libya, it's going to be all the more complicated because the restitution claims are also intertwined with the practices of the Gaddafi regime over decades. The Gaddafi regime would use land conflicts and the allocation of land resources as a way of playing different groups off of one another. And this, of course, results in very complex overlapping claims to the same properties. So in terms of thinking into the future, when we can hope to see this situation sorted out, the restitution piece is going to be a big part of that. I think that there's work that can be done in terms of forward planning for strategies to address that situation. That's just one example. I think that there are a range of ways in which there can be effective forward planning. It might seem sort of idealistic at this moment because the security concerns are obviously paramount, but I think it behooves us to do what we can in the situation we're in at the moment.
I want to turn to this issue of hospitality or compassion fatigue. You know, when you step back even from this region, we're just overwhelmed with humanitarian simultaneous mega crises. Everybody I know in the humanitarian sector is exhausted, you know, running from one crisis to another and trying to raise money. And I mean, in this situation, Tunisia gets very little international attention. And here I'm struck by the fact that, you know, you've had this generous, hospitable reaction to refugees from a neighboring country for several years now. And I mean, is there anything that the international community could do to recognize the tremendous efforts you've done to address that compassion fatigue?
Yeah, I mean, this question of hospitality fatigue is a common feature all over the world. But I think it means it's complicated further by a sense of disillusionment. Disillusionment with people who thought were euphoric about the revolution and thought that overnight the situation will change, they will have economic opportunity, employment for everybody, and have very high standards of living overnight. Of course, it did not happen in Tunisia. The process there was very, very slow and was very painful. The economic rewards are not there yet. So there is a sense of disillusionment. Economic disillusionment, at least. I mean, there is now a sense of political pride in what Tunisia has achieved, but economically there is some disillusionment. To be honest, too, there is some disillusionment about the international community and sometimes about our neighbors, because Tunisians thought that they were generous above their means and that they made sacrifices, but that hospitality was not returned. When there were possibilities in these countries, Tunisians were not considered immediately to have some job opportunities or whatever. So there is this sense of general fatigue that is both because of the effort that is being made and the long time that this effort is being made, but also because there is a sense of disillusionment. In terms of what can be done, I mean, the international community could help. The Libyan authorities, whichever, could also help. Because one of the issues that Tunisian authorities have discussed before is that we have Libyans living here, that they are benefiting from subsidies. We cannot limit subsidies to Tunisians only, so they are welcome in our countries and to benefit from them. But we ask in return maybe some kind of preferential rate for oil, to cover that kind of subsidies, particularly in the energy sector. It did not work, but now the situation is even worse with the with the infighting between governments or authorities in Libya itself. The international community, we always hear about these complaints in Italy, in France, about number of refugees and economic migrants. But as you have just mentioned, it does not compare with what Lebanon is doing, without complaining, with what Tunisia is doing. They receive 5,000 or something, and all the press, all the country, and everything is about that issue. We are receiving millions. Over 10% of our population are refugees. So in a sense, there should be more international responsibility, sharing of costs, sharing of sacrifices. That is not taking place, but I hope that things will prove that these, even in the interest of, let's say, on the north of the Mediterranean, because if you help with these countries, maybe you can reduce the influx of migrants to your countries too.
Just to jump in on this question of compassion fatigue, there was a really interesting piece of public opinion research that was done in March by a French and Tunisian firm working in cooperation with the Konrad Adenauer Foundation. And this research found, interestingly, that when Tunisians were asked to identify their top two ways in which their government could help to respond to the Libyan crisis, 72% of respondents picked accepting refugees from Libya as one of the two key ways to respond. So I think, on the one hand, this is a great testimony to how people do continue to maintain a very generous spirit despite this kind of compassion fatigue. And yet, the population was split almost down the line on the question of whether Libyan families should actually be allowed to integrate into Tunisian society. So there was, a lot more resistance to the notion of hospitality going further than just keeping the border open, which I think comes back to this question of hospitality fatigue and how hard it is to sustain these kinds of open policies in the longer term.
Can I?
And if I may?
Yeah, please.
And regrettably, if you look at the world map today, the situation's only going to get worse. And so I think that, the conflicts are proliferating. There are more conflicts. Every month there's a new emergency. We've just declared, moving away from this particular region, we've just declared a level one emergency in Rwanda because of the outflow of some 8,000 Burundian refugees. Who would have thought, after having engaged in a major repatriation program to Burundi? So only to suggest that The nature of things these times reflects increased conflict, more violent conflict. You spoke of the beheading of the Christians, just more unpredictability, more impunity and less management of existing conflicts. They become more protracted. So we have protracted emergencies in ways that we didn't have before. And Beth, you know from your long experience in refugees that an emergency lasted 6 months, not 5 years, like in the Middle East now. And so that's why we think that it's really important to think in bigger terms, because the humanitarian financial system is broken. It cannot sustain this kind of commitment. And already we're satisfied with with what we can do when we're 50% funded, and we've had to make some very serious choices. But when it gets to structural support and issues relating to services in host countries, we can't wait to engage the international community in that reflection. And it's not just a question of being nice, of being compassionate. There are security issues for states that are next to some of these failed states, where if there's a risk, it needs to be addressed in a very proactive way, in a big way, and that requires more than just a few projects. It requires a more systemic and sustained structural approach.
Just to comment this idea of the poll, I don't like to be selective and accept the first part and reject the second, but I think for the second question, if you ask me the same question, I would respond the same way. We think that it's the idea of integration is not good. But it's not because of rejection. I think it's rational kind of behavior. It's not rejection. Because if you say we would like to have them integrated, there is a recognition of failure, there is a total despair of the situation of Libya. I think it is more rational in the sense that we wish them success and they are welcome here, but we hope that they will have a positive solution in the near future. I personally would think this way if I'm asking this question, rather than rejection of integration. But even before the revolution, I mean, now we have, let's say, 1 million refugees, but even before the revolution, at all time during the year, we have always around 1 million Libyans in Tunisia, coming for tourism, coming for medical care, so they are part of society. If 10% number is already there, is always there. In better conditions, for good purposes and for good reasons, but in this case now, it's not a matter of choice.
Thanks. And one question more, and then we'll open it up for discussion. To you, Shelley, are European governments doing enough in responding to the exodus of boats from Libya? I mean, many of us thought that Mare Nostrum was a wonderful Italian initiative that ended. Is something like that needed? Not to put you on the spot.
You can. It's okay. Mm-hmm. That's why I'm here. The Mare Nostrum was perceived by Europe to be a pull factor. And without too much controversy, it's pretty clear now that in the year that's followed, the numbers have increased, the numbers of deaths have increased on the high sea. So Mare Nostrum was a good initiative by Italy, and it should have benefited from more support from Europe generally. But that's that. It is what it is, one could say. And now there's the Triton alternative approach, which is focused more on border control, border management. Yesterday, the European Council decided to triple the investment in the Triton initiative, in the Triton operation, which is, I guess, a fair reaction to what has been happening in the month of April, especially with the last tragedy. Most of you should know by now that 900 people or more died in one single accident. 1,200 people have died already on the sea, on the high seas, since 1,776 since the beginning of this year. So it's not a problem that's going to go away. And now, certainly with the season being as it is, there will be more boat traffic and hopefully there will be more rescue. But it can be said that Germany and Sweden in particular have been remarkably generous in their approach, just in particular for Syrian refugees coming to Sweden and to Germany as asylum seekers directly or through programs of resettlement or humanitarian admissions. We've been calling for a more generous approach using flexible visa, family reunification, resettlement, or anything that would allow for more access, legal, safe, secure, predictable access by Syrian refugees in particular to European states on a more generalized and equitable basis. That, unfortunately, did not come out of the European Council decision yesterday, although there's movement in that direction, but no firm decision in that respect. There's still, for very good reason, a focus on trafficking and on smuggling, and that's important in and of itself because it represents risks, of course, to migrants and to refugees, but it doesn't provide a safe alternative to those people who are forced to flee to find security and safety.
All right, thanks. We'll open it up now for questions and maybe take several at a time. If you could introduce yourself and we'll start over here, please.
I'd like to, Bill Lawrence, I'd like to press a little further on that last point and on the economic piece of this. I agree with you that conflict is the main problem here, not just regular old economic deprivation. But if you look at the fact that most Tunisians work in the informal economic sector, Libyans are being pushed into to work now in the informal sector, that this is informal flows of labor across the Med. You know, that large numbers of these flows are coming from West Africa, not just Mali, but Senegal, Gambia. If you look at the numbers, we have a lot of informal economic sector activity here. So my question for you is, when the UN looks at livelihoods and crises and how to deal with refugees, how do they deal with this whole informal economic sector piece and constructing economies that'll work? And then for Megan, just a very much quicker question. You alluded to the Tunisian high figures of 1.5 or even 1.9 million they talk about, and the Egyptians often say they have even more Libyans. And you aptly pointed out that it's tied to the whole Gaddafi, those tied to the regime. But my question for you is, what precedent is there, what models are there for external reconciliation, right? There are a lot of Libyans who aren't going to go back until they feel there's a safety in going back. So how do we deal with international dialogue with an exiled population that fears to return? It's like the Twarga inside, the Twarga problem inside, but, what are the models for that? Because they won't come back until there's some sort of...
Yeah. Let's take a couple more, and if you could stand up, please, I think it helps people to hear better. And this gentleman right here, yes?
Thank you. Michael Boyce from Refugees International. Thank you all very much for your presentations. A question regarding the IDP response. Of course, we see in other settings where IDP populations are less inaccessible, like Somalia or Syria, that humanitarian organizations often use remote control mechanisms, working from a neighboring country and then using particularly local actors, civil society, local NGOs to distribute the aid within the country. Of course, that's never a perfect solution, especially when it comes to ensuring proper protection for IDPs, but I wonder if you could talk a bit about the extent to which this is already being used or being considered for the Libyan context.
Thank you, and we'll take the gentleman in the very back there.
Jeff Drumtra, independent consultant on humanitarian issues. A comment and a question. First, as someone who has often pointed to flaws of UNHCR, I think it's only fair to give UNHCR a lot of credit for the reporting that you have done in UNHCR's annual reports over the last several years. UNHCR has consistently reported on the number of deaths at sea of people trying to flee the Horn of Africa and Northern Africa to Europe and other parts of the Middle East. And on an annual basis, the estimates have been in 2,000 to 3,000 per year perish at sea. So this is not new. The only difference in this latest incident last week is that they were all on one ship. If those 900 people had been on four different ships and had died 200 apiece, it would not have been in the media and we would not be hearing about it. But this is not new, and UNHCR has had this in their reporting for several years. Which leads me to my question, primarily to Shelley, but also if the other panelists have views on this. On this migration, asylum-seeking, fleeing by boat, in Libya, does UNHCR and its implementing partners have any leverage to influence the most dangerous and abusive practices of the traffickers? And similar to that, does UNHCR and its partners have you had any success in raising awareness among would-be asylum seekers and migrants before they depart Libya about safer alternatives to reach their destination? Thank you.
Hey, we've got some complex questions here. I invite anybody to jump in and answer. A question on the relationship of informal migrants mixed in with asylum seekers, external reconciliation, the question of UNHCR and others doing remote management to work inside Libya, and does UNHCR have any influence with the trafficking element inside the country? Who would like to begin?
Maybe I should give some of it a go. Perhaps in direct response to the question about the labor sector, it's not so much in the countries of origin so to speak, that we would engage, I mean, we're directly, but certainly in the countries of asylum, we're trying to get more involved and hear the buzzword, the key word, the official word is resilience. So, for example, in the context of the Syrian refugee response, for the first time, and in a very collaborative way, and hopefully it will be effective in terms of generating new resources, we've talked not only about responding to the refugee piece of our work in the countries of asylum, but also resilience for the host community and putting into place certain activities through UNDP, through other development-oriented organizations, to respond to the impact of large numbers of refugees on the services in the host countries, and livelihoods, and helping refugees and people in the host community to keep up income generation. What we're already seeing very quickly, though, and this gets back to the earlier point that I made, is that these are inadequate responses because of just the availability of funds. Even if we begin to tap into the development pool of funding, they're inadequate responses to the kinds of issues that were mentioned with respect to Tunisia and Lebanon, where you have real structural challenges at a big, in a big way that impact on national security in the short or medium term. And in these areas, what we're going for is important. It's essential, but it's insufficient. I think in terms of really keeping asylum space preserved and also keeping countries that do provide asylum secure. And so that's, I think, the first piece. The second I would very quickly mention is that we've never denied that the movements by sea are mixed, whether it's in the Caribbean or the Red Sea or in the East Pacific or, for that matter, in the Mediterranean. So there need to be mechanisms which are lacking in all four examples for identifying people who are indeed in need of international protection and dealing with that according to international and national law on the one hand, and those who are migrants addressing their concerns, however that's done by IOM and by the host countries, and if it's according to the law, then returning them safely to their point of departure or to their country of origin. Those mechanisms are just not in place anywhere, frankly, in a systematic, coherent, and predictable way. So that's why the High Commissioner took the initiative last December to have a dialogue, an international dialogue on protection at sea, which was prescient, which was well-timed in order to begin to have all states think about, well, what are the mechanisms that need to be introduced in order to provide those protections on the one hand and protect state interests on the other, not that they're mutually exclusive by any means. And just in very quick reply on the remote management for IDPs, it's a very modest, as I indicated, but Megan may have more to say about this. Like I said, we have our international presence out of Tunis. We have national staff in Tripoli and Benghazi. We work with NGOs, both international and national, to do what we can. The program is underfunded. Access is very limited. And so there's no pretense that what we're doing is anything on the order of the cross-line operations, or for that matter, the cross-border operations, as well, in the Syrian context or other IDP, emergency situations. And with respect to Jeff, thank you very much for your observation. In fact, we have always, together with IOM, spoken about deaths to the extent that we can count them. We get this information from Coast Guards, so they're not, you know, our numbers, but we publish them because they're part of the movements of people of concern or potentially of concern. And I misquoted the number of deaths on the Mediterranean. Since January, it's 1776. So that's a number that I should have more easily remembered. 1,296 in April, of which 900 or so. But the numbers are also not as precise as we pretend. Several dozens in the Caribbean already this year that we get from the U.S. Coast Guard, from the Bahamian and the Turks and Caicos Coast Guards as well. So as far as I have to say that my short answer to your question is I don't know, but I don't think so. I don't imagine that we have relationships as such with traffickers in order to be able to give them some guidance or training on best practice. I just don't think that that's likely. And similarly, the whole nature of this being as secretive, as that it's very hard, I'm sure, for us to give good advice to refugees or asylum seekers about the best way to manage this travel. That's why, and then I'll stop, we have focused on the need for states to introduce structures, transparent, predictable structures that address the needs of asylum seekers, and to give them legal alternatives through creative and flexible visa arrangements, resettlement programs, humanitarian admission programs, or safe points of departure in order to be able to address their protection needs.
Megan, external reconciliation?
Thank you for a really interesting question. You know, it's certainly true that historically reconciliation processes, transitional justice processes, have tended to be very nationally bound. So they haven't taken into account the regional and cross-border dynamics of refugee flows and the ways in which refugees can be, as we would say in political science, spoilers in the context of peace processes, which is to say that they, if their needs are not met, they can potentially undercut those processes and jeopardize their success. That said, there have been some interesting developments on this front. One of the report co-authors, Ibrahim Sharkia, has actually done extensive research on reconciliation and dialogue processes in the Arab Spring countries, which in some cases have had an international dimension to them. In Libya, in the Libyan case particularly, there have been some individually driven efforts to try to have reconciliation with and dialogue with Libyans in the diaspora. These processes have often really been severely criticized by people within Libya who are opposed to the notion of reconciliation. There's still, I think, as we saw in our research, strong relevance of this divide between perceived loyalists and revolutionaries. Some have suggested that in the context of the upsurge in violence since 2014, the salience of those divides has reduced. What we've seen is that that's not so much the case, which is not surprising. I mean, the regime was longstanding, and the kinds of divides that sows are going to run deep. The other thing that I would say on this question of external reconciliation processes is that we often tend to focus on reconciliation in terms of formal political processes of dialogue and, you know, actually having people sit down together around a table in a political process. What I've seen in some of my research is that reconciliation can often be significantly promoted in more informal ways, particularly through reestablishing economic ties, for example, supporting families to reconnect across borders, communities to reconnect across borders. And these kinds of economically rooted and informal processes can be just as significant, if not more significant, than the formal political processes. And just on the question of remote management and cross-border operations, I think it's just important to recognize that the Libyan Red Crescent has really been carrying so much of the weight in terms of the response that is happening to the IDP situation, and that moving forward, perhaps it will be important to think more seriously about the role of cross-border relief, thinking about the experiences that have taken place in Syria, you know, troubled as they have been, but could perhaps have some important insights for the Libyan case.
Thank you very much.
Yes? A couple of comments. On the idea of remote border management, that reminds me that we have another category of refugees in Tunisia, and that's diplomatic refugees, including UNHCR, the U.S. Embassy, the Canadian Embassy, and so many embassies.
Thank you for your attention.
You're welcome. But that's to move to a more serious issue. It's about this mixed picture between economic asylum seekers and humanitarian asylum seekers. I think the major flaw that we are seeing now, the major problem that we are seeing now is this concentration on the pull factors. And we forget about the push factors. I mean, obviously, the push factor, it is a catastrophe out of proportion. It is something we have not seen for so many years. We are speaking about 14 to 15 million IDPs in the region. Few people would take this opportunity, take this wave to try to smuggle themselves into this wave into Europe as economic asylum seekers. But if we deal with the catastrophe as it is and try to find solutions to it, political solutions and sometimes security solutions and other possibilities to offer asylum, then we can really separate between the genuine humanitarian asylum seekers and the economic seekers. But let's concentrate on the real issue, on this real catastrophe, before looking into the pull factors or into some people who would opportunistic, people who would take this opportunity to travel illegally to Europe or somewhere else. And I think that yesterday I was listening to the NPR, to the Special Rapporteur of the United States, United Nations Secretary General on refugee issues, and he cited the example in the 1970s where countries like Canada, the US, Europe have formally welcomed thousands of people from Burma, from many other countries in the Asia region, and it was a successful model. And they are now good citizens in these countries, they have their children in universities, and they are totally integrated, and they contributed to the economies of these countries.
All right, let's open it up for another round of questions. Yes, please, ma'am. And if you could introduce yourself.
Hello, Kirsten Schüttler from the World Bank. Thank you very much for this very interesting discussion and for taking up the topic, because we've also been feeling that Tunisia and the Libyan context have been a bit overshadowed by other developments. I was having two questions. First question, we are reading very different numbers in the news on the number of people waiting in Libya to cross the Mediterranean. We know that there are migrants there that were, I mean, most of them who were working in Libya had already fled in 2011, but I guess some returned and some are still there. Then there are some asylum seekers there. There were some recognized refugees that the UNHCR mentioned. So I was wondering if anybody had a clear picture of what is actually happening there, because we read a lot of anecdotal evidence about what's happening in detention centers, what's happening in smugglers' houses. Do we know? Because I've read numbers from 1.5 million, 2 million people waiting, 500,000 waiting to cross. And what is their situation? The other question I would have, we heard a little bit about Libyan refugees in Tunisia, and I was wondering if we have a little bit more information about the different groups that are there and what their economic status and their well-being is like, because I guess that this information would be very important also for the Tunisian authorities to have, to then have a targeted approach to how to react to these refugees and how to react, seeing also the state of the Tunisian economy. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good questions. The gentleman back here.
Hello. Matt Wiltz from the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. And my question is about durable solutions in this situation, and especially in Libya and in Tunisia, for the refugees and IDPs in those situations. And you had, of course, mentioned that the great hope for the vast majority is to return when there's peace. And certainly Tunisia is very overloaded in terms of integration for people, local integration. So my question is about resettlement and what role you think it has in this situation, and both in terms of protecting people and also giving alternatives to that dangerous flight.
Dr. Diab from the Libyan Embassy, do you want to speak? No, okay. Yes, please.
Hi, Ella Abuzakouk, National Endowment for Democracy. Thank you very much. This is a highly timely panel, maybe even overdue. I have two questions. First, understanding the constraints and the limitations of working with IDPs inside Libya, specifically those that are coming out of the city of Benghazi, which has been under heavy bombardment for almost the past year. What kind of services are being provided to the IDPs, be it shouldered by Libyan Red Crescent or other international organizations? And then secondly, a lot of the discussion is about Tunisia, and that's great. What about the situation of Libyan outflow, the refugees that are in Egypt, Turkey, Jordan, other host countries? If you guys have a little bit more context about that, that would be good to know as well. Thank you.
Take one last question in the back here.
My name is Ahmed Nabil. I'm second secretary of the Embassy of Egypt here. I'm familiar a little bit with the situation in Tunisia. I have posted before to Libya from 2009 till 2012, and I have participated in evacuation of hundreds and thousands from the refugees in south of Tunisia, from Egyptians and from third nationalities. So I'm going, actually, I don't have a question. I have a comment to shed the light on the situation in Egypt about the Libyans that are there. The number of the Libyans who are only Libyans, they are not Libyan Egyptians. You are talking about 700,000 Libyans only. Before the revolution, that we used to have 500,000 Libyans, they are living in Egypt. Also, now there are no campus in Egypt for refugees. All of these people, they are living. They have houses and they have for services for their son in universities and schools. There's no any problem for them. And they are used to be dealt like Egyptians in some situations and in some services. We have similar problem like Tunisia, that's in relations to the subsides, that we couldn't limit the subsides to only Egyptians. And at the same time, that Egypt used to receive very big numbers of Arab refugees from other countries, not only Libya, that we received after the war in Iraq, that's around 250,000 Iraqis, they are living in Egypt. And now we have 350,000 Syrian, and with the number of the Libyans, and we used to have 1 million Sudanese. All of this, as Egypt is suffering internally from economic problems, and we're still suffering with the increasing in the intensity of the problem of the refugees from Arab countries like Tunisia. Actually, that's a little bit similar situation. But the problem for us, actually, we have humanitarian and economic problem, and another dimension is very important for us, that's the security. After the revolution directly against Gaddafi, that many Libyans, some of them supporters of Gaddafi and some of them supporters of the revolution against Gaddafi, came to Egypt, and they have sometimes represented like security threat in Egypt because they are used to fighting in shopping malls and sometimes in the streets using armies. Not only this, there's a very big number of weapons, amounts of weapons that's smuggled from Libya to Egypt after directly the revolution. And till now, that's don't forget, there's a very big number of the extremist groups. They are concentrated mainly in the eastern part of Libya, in Derna, Benghazi, and now Sirte. Also, this also very big challenging for Egypt. Maybe you heard about the incident that happened last year, the end of last year, for the Egyptian border guards, when their group of them, they were assassinated by terrorist groups. They are coming mainly from Libya. So that's complicated, highly complicated for us, not only in Egypt, not only humanitarian and economy, the security and terrorism dimension is very important for us. That's all, and I have tried only to shed light on the situation in Egypt. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I think it illustrates how complex these patterns of displacement are, and over time with different groups and different countries and economic and security and humanitarian concerns. Certainly not an easy issue. Now for the panelists, we've got some difficult questions. How many are waiting to cross? Different groups of Libyan refugees? Where are we with durable solutions, resettlement, integration, and so forth? What kind of services are being provided to IDPs in Benghazi and elsewhere? And I think we just had some response on the Egypt question. So who would like, the first person who answers gets to choose which questions to ask. Yes, please.
I'll try to answer the first question about the different groups and categories in Tunisia. We cannot come really with a precise number first. Maybe the margins are quite narrow, from 1 million to 1 million 800,000. So the margin is really very, very, very wide. We do not have any precise figures and no clear census. And this is one, and since you are from the World Bank, this is one of the issues that Tunisia has discussed quite recently with the World Bank, and we are going to undertake a comprehensive study about the impact on the economy of the Libyans in Tunisia. But let me try to say something about these groups. I think most of Libyans in Tunisia are from the middle class. They do not, for the moment, have any financial problems. There is some kind of gap in wealth that you could maybe detect by the town of residence of Libyans. The more you move north, the richer you are. So those who are not 12 will stay near the borders in Medinin, Tataouin. Little more richer will go to Gabes. Those who are rich enough will opt for Sousse, Hammamet, or Tunis in particular. But that does not mean that there are some who have financial difficulties and who have problems of schooling, problems of getting to access to the health system. The other thing about political affiliation, if you like, there is no monitor to see the conscience of people in Tunisia, but we have seen some minor tension between different Libyans in Tunisia. Fortunately, it was contained, and I think, but there are from every side. Maybe most of them are pro-Gaddafi citizens, but we do not have any kind of idea about that. Mm-hmm. But we have seen some kind of tension that was contained. And maybe that gives ideas to the possibilities of external reconciliation, but I don't know if it works or if it is taking place. But we managed to contain the tension between Libyans, and I don't think there are any problems. Sometimes it's very minor incidents, but totally under control. Okay. Thanks to the Libyans themselves, because they are behaving properly.
My answers here will be short. I don't know. I don't know the answer. Maybe somebody else does, even in the room, about how many potential folks there are that will leave by boat. I just don't know. There may be some estimates out there, but I just don't happen to know them. As far as the level of assistance, I think I intimated that it's inadequate. It's focused on some non-food items to those who can get access. We always try to provide protection support for children who are impacted, or for women, specific groups that might have their stories and need counseling. But I can't pretend that it's more than it is. Partly that's a function of access. Partly it's a function of resources. It's certainly not a function of will, and Megan correctly said, I intimated before, that we rely on national NGOs as well, and that's in first and foremost the Libyan Red Crescent. We also have support for folks who have been returned or intercepted by the Libyan Coast Guard or Navy and brought back, who are then brought to detention centers where the conditions are not good, and we've provided some individual support to them in collaboration with the International Medical Corps. So these are, what we can do. And I think the bottom line is that, in fact, it's true that this situation has not benefited from the level of media, public, and donor attention as much as it should.
which relates to my point about just bandwidth and financial resources. To the extent that the World Bank and Tunisia are in communication, you may want to think about what flexible and creative options there might be. I draw attention here as well to the fact that when we did go for the Syrian refugee appeal, I had mentioned that we had in our refugee response plan an element on resilience to support the host community. And there were chapters in that appeal that were crafted by both Jordan and Lebanon to speak to their needs as far as services and infrastructure support in a bigger way. And that might be a useful reference as well for Tunisia. Matt's question with respect to resettlement, I think, is quite timely. And frankly, here too, I must admit that I don't know the answer. I don't know what the realistic prospects are would be for processing out. But it would fall within the framework of giving, especially for Europe, an organized legal alternative to receive refugees who are now in trouble in Libya. And we have nationalities, we have Syrian refugees. Of course, they're about half as far as we're able to estimate and be in contact with them of the 40,000 or so refugees. But there are also, as I mentioned, Eritrean refugees. Let me just mention some of the other nationalities that we've got. There are Palestinian refugees from Eritrea, Iraq, Somalia, and Sudan, among other nationalities on an individual basis.
Anything else on solutions, Megan?
Well, on the question of resettlement, I think when we reflect on the relevance of this opportunity for Libyans, we have to recognize that, well, globally, 1% of refugees access resettlement, so the numbers are already very low. The vast majority of exiled Libyans are not registered as refugees. So for them to even begin to contemplate access to resettlement, there would have to be a real shift in the approach to start with a much more comprehensive registration process that could identify who is most in need of resettlement, given that it's now widely understood that resettlement opportunities should be provided as a protection tool. It's also important to recognize that resettlement would be a very limited, there would be very limited access, if any, to IDPs. So sometimes we tend to focus on resettlement and it can detract attention from the larger numbers of people who are trapped within their own countries and who will never have an opportunity to participate in that process. On the durable solutions question, I would also just stress that it's important to recognize in a case like this that so-called durable solutions are not going to mean an end to mobility. So as the participant from the Egyptian embassy pointed out, and also Mr. Dereji indicated in his comments, there are long-standing Libyan communities in Egypt and Tunisia. People have historically moved very freely and fluidly across those borders, and that kind of movement will be a part of what a durable solution to this situation looks like. So we shouldn't expect that all of a sudden we'll have a more sedentary dynamic in the region. People will continue to engage in mobility as part of their livelihood strategies and their way of life. In terms of the question on the economic status and well-being of Libyans in Tunisia, it's great to hear that a study is being contemplated that would look at those issues from a quantitative perspective. The qualitative research that we did for this study certainly can't be generalized to the whole population, but did underline that while the majority of exiled Libyans are indeed middle class, there are people who are facing real impoverishment and who are being pushed to engage in what we might euphemistically call negative coping strategies to deal with that reality. And so it's important that we not lose sight of that population and the particular protection concerns that they have.
I want to thank all the panelists. These are complex issues. And, you know, beyond the statistics and the descriptions and the terminology are real life human beings, you know, who are caught up in conflict, who are fleeing for their lives, who are scared, who are poor. And I think these discussions have to
remember that these are people that we're talking about and that they have serious needs. Thanks to our panelists, Megan Bradley, Shelley, and Mr. Dorici. Join me in thanking them.